an Ironic Media production.
Visit us at ironickmedia.com.
This is an interview with one of my old everyday hero buddies, Captain Bill Kirshner. Bill's now 84 years old, but still sharp as ever. He and I flew together at TWA and at Saudi Arabian Airlines in the late 70s, where we were both on temporary assignment in Jeddah, Saudi Arabia. One of the reasons I'm interviewing people like Bill, I want you to be able to look back over our shoulders into the glory days of aviation, an era that I was privileged to be a part of, and a time we'll never see again. I asked Bill about his beginnings as an aviator and how he progressed over his 36-year flying career. But I especially wanted you to hear about his experience as a pilot and check captain for Saudi Arabian Airlines out of Jeddah, Saudi Arabia, in the late 70s and early 80s. You're going to love the special parts of his interview, especially his experience with his Saudi pilot students, who actually memorized the Quran as kids, and how that affected their pilot skills, flying kids in some of the most remote desert regions of the Saudi Arabian Kingdom. You pilots and aviation enthusiasts are especially going to like his innovative fog dispersal technique at the Saudi Arabian Dhahran Airport, and also his escape experiences to his European villas. You'll hear him mention the term Kwaji. It's a term of questionable affection that the Arabs use to describe us American aviators who've worked for the airline. Stick around to the end of the podcast while you'll hear him have to stop and remember how many true hero experiences he had in his own Miracle on the Hudson. I somewhat apologize for the length of this podcast, but as they say in podcast land, make it as long as it needs to be to tell the story. So put on your headset, strap in, and come along for the flight back in time to the glory days of aviation, where we flew the Queen of the Skies to parts unknown at the time. Hey, Everyday Heroes, I'm Bert Botta. Do you know what every man wants? If you can't come up immediately with the answer to that question, then pay close attention to my Everyday Heroes podcast series for golfs. That means guys over 50. And if you're not a guy over 50, or even if you're a gal, don't worry. There's going to be some very cool stuff here for both men and women. I've discovered answers to the kind of questions that every man has. And now I'm ready to help you put those answers to work in your life through these podcasts. If you take in what I have to share, it very well could change your life and help you do more than just push back the aging process. And my podcasts are mostly about aviation everyday heroes, but they're going to be a mix of women and men heroes just like you. So let's jump into this and see if what we talk about here helps bring out your own everyday hero.
I am one of the few TWA captains that started in fleet service, washing airplanes and emptying pots. So, but I'll get to that.
Ooh, love it. I love that.
Yeah, right. Well, the way I got interested in aviation was my father was a really wonderful model airplane builder. So I built gliders as a kid and all that kind of stuff. But then I was also very interested in underwater photography. And I was also a qualified engine mechanic when I got out of the Navy and got hired with the TWA in September 9th of 1960, washing airplanes and emptying pots off the Connies and all that. The reason that I did that was the recommendation was to get involved with TWA seniority ASAP because they had a mechanic slot coming open. So I did, and sure enough, December of that year, I was an engine mechanic with the TWA, and I was in college at the time to get my associate's in arts degree in aircraft maintenance engineering, which means I really know how to clean an airplane.
Especially the labs.
especially the labs, right? Yeah, exactly. So I was a mechanic with them for 3.5 years, but I was flying full-time, getting all my civilian ratings, and eventually in April of 1963, I went to work with Zentop Air Transport up in Detroit, Michigan. I got a furlough notice from Zentop November of that year. In the same mailbox, I got a letter from TWA asking me if I could make a class starting date of November 18th of 1963. Could I? And so I started with them that year, and flew all the way until August of 1996, which I had to retire at age 60.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And then along the way, I checked out. I was the first new hire to check out as captain. That was May of 1967. And then I went from the DC-9 to the Convair 880 to the 707, 727, L-1011, and then the 747. And I instructed on most of those airplanes, the 880 and the 707, 1011, and 747. We had the Saudi contract in 1976. We had some friends that were over there, Rufus Mosley and a few other guys. We were at a party one night in Incline Village, Nevada. One of them was explaining, he and his wife were there, and they were explaining what they were doing in Saudi and how much fun it was and that kind of stuff. And my wife says, hey, why don't we do something like that? So I had been instructing on the 7-0 out of San Francisco. I went in to see Jack Robertson, the chief pilot. And next thing I know, September of 1976, I was in Jeddah, Saudi Arabia, along with an old buddy, Bert Botta.
But we didn't get there till we got kicked off the 1011, right? Remember?
Yeah, well, that's exactly right. Yeah, yeah. So for some reason, that captain did not like Quadjis, as we were called.
Right.
Yeah. Even though TWA checked him out, got him all his licenses and all that kind of stuff. He was very aggressive against Westerners, as it were.
Yeah.
That's kind of the way it goes. Yeah, because as I remember, it took us, what, about a week or 10 days to get down there, huh?
Oh, yeah. We suffered in London there, you know, for quite a while until we got permission to get back in the cockpit again. I guess they called up Saudi and said, you better get these guys down here. We're paying them, you know, so we want to put them to work.
Yeah, we suffered for a week or 10 days at the full company expense.
Yeah, that was beautiful.
Yeah, that really was. Yeah, so we got down there and checked out on the 7-0, and then eventually, well, I was instructing on the 707. The gentleman that was heading up the whole program, Wes Mattinen, had to leave to come back to TWA to fly the 1011 and asked me to take over that whole 707 operation down there, which I did. Kind of an interesting thing. When I got the 707 project from Wes, he was using a simulator in a Karachi, Pakistan, a 707 simulator, and it was terrible.
Mm-hmm.
And so I needed to do something. But what really changed my mind, we had a training scenario going on over there, and came back one night to go to the Intercontinental Hotel, and they had hung President Bhutto from the power lines outside the Intercontinental Hotel. And I thought, time to make a move, Willie. So I did. I went up and checked out Lufthansa simulators, Cairo, Egypt Air simulators, eventually settled on a brand new Qantas simulator that was given to the Jordanians in Amman, Jordan. So I moved my training program up to Amman, Jordan. It was there all the way until we left in 1983. And that simulator was terrific because it had side window capability, which meant you could give rating rides in the sim.
Uh-huh.
So, yeah. But then we also did the training. All our ratings eventually would culminate in an airplane check ride where an FAA guy would come over from New York. And so all of our ratings were top quality FAA ATP ratings at the time.
Now, were your students both Saudis and Quadjis?
Yeah, mainly Quadjis, and I would say about two-thirds Quadjis, a third Saudis.
These guys were they Saudi new hires, or were they had been experienced in other aircraft? What was your experience instructing them?
Well, by the time I got them, Bert, they had been a co-pilot and then captains on the 737. When they showed up on our 707, my 707 program, they had about 5,000 hours of pilot and command time, and they were all very, very good.
Mm-hmm.
The only deficiency that I could see was the ability to think outside the training manuals, as were. Because they were taught to memorize the Koran from scratch as children, they could memorize any of the aircraft manuals, including the 707 manual. So I had to explain to them that you could go right off the end of the runway with that book in your lap. So, yeah. So, but they were very good. They learned very quickly. and they were all very, very nice individuals. Now, they liked the Quadgies, and I liked them. I mean, so we got along really well.
What kind of flying did you do over there? And what was your experience going into some of those other places that, you know, like we weren't used to? How long did it take you to get used to operating over there in and out of the desert strips and places like that?
Yeah, well, I tell you what, that's an outstanding question. It's like going into Medina, the runway at Medina sits right at the edge of a lava flow. You could get all kinds of winds off the end of that runway, but we would do a line training. In other words, we would ride around the system prior to getting into the left seat solo. And so I learned a lot about that. So by the time I got to fly my own airplane, I was very well versed in all of the airports.
I remember Medina, I never got out of the co-pilot seat over there because I wasn't rated and I didn't go over there as a captain. But as I remember, one guy I was flying with, and I don't remember who it was, he wouldn't let me look out the window because I was infidel and I wasn't supposed to be looking at the city. Was that the same experience you had?
Well, I could look at the city because I was in the left seat and all that kind of stuff.
But I couldn't.
Yeah, so you must have been with an Arab guy.
Oh, I was with Saudi Khadib or whatever.
Right. Mohammed Khadib or something like that.
Yeah, something like that. Yeah. But it was really funny. I said, well, how do you want me to fly this thing if I'm not supposed to look out the window?
So, good luck with that.
Yeah, exactly. So we worked it out. But
Oh, God. Yeah. So in answer to your question, I guess, Bert, was I really paid attention to every flight, every leg, and every airport. I really studied the airports by going to, Europe and wherever, especially the further east you got, like Karachi and Hong Kong and a few places that we were going into, Bombay. So I really familiarized myself with all those prior to going in.
Yeah. And what were some of the tougher ones? I mean, besides Hong Kong, besides the Kai Tak.
Well, you had to be careful about Medina because of that sloping lava flow winds. I did a lot of my training up in Taif, which was an outstanding airport. But here again, lots of wind right off the Red Sea. So I'd take my students up there early in the morning because I would know the afternoon you're going to have winds all over the place.
Yeah.
Dahran was pretty straightforward. Oh, you'll get a kick out of this. You remember this fog we used to have in Dahran?
Yeah.
Okay, so we get out into the airplane, and it's 00. I mean, it's pretty much rocks off. But I really needed to get back to Jeddah for a training program that I had coming up. So I asked, this is no joke, I asked Dahran Tower if we could get permission to taxi the length of the runway. And with the RVR, it was 00, So we got permission. So what I did was I briefed the crew. I said, okay, guys, here's what we're going to do. We're going to run engines 2 and 3 forward, and we're going to put 1 and 4 in reverse, and we're going to taxi that whole runway. Swear to God. Okay, so we're about half power down there, that kind of stuff. Because we weren't going very fast because 1 and 4 were fighting 2 and 3. We're probably doing about 8 knots all the way down that runway. But what it did was it changed the temperature and dew point, and now got down to the end of the runway. And Dahran Tower says, sorry, whatever our number was, is the RVR is now a CAV OK. I said, hey, requesting takeoff clearance because we were all ready to go. Turned around and blasted off. Well, what I didn't know was the Royal Flight, the guys that fly the Learjets, they were behind us. And he said, nice job, Saudi. And I looked around. I swear to God, I wish I had a picture of it. The only swath of earth you could see was the whole length of that runway. Everything was covered for hundreds of miles around with that fog.
Yeah. It's funny.
Yeah, a really true story.
That didn't become part of your operational procedures, though, did it?
No, it didn't. But I did explain to several of the guys that I checked out, the TWA guys coming over, that was possible.
And
what a riot. Then I finished up the 7-0 program over there, came back, and I requalified on the 727, waiting for a slot on the 1011. Went to the 1011 and checked out. I instructed on that for about 3 years. And then in 1986, had an opportunity to go to the TWA Training Center on the 747 at Kennedy and became an instructor on the 74 all the way up until the end when I retired in August of 1996.
Oh, that is cool. That's when you commute?
Yeah, I commuted out of Lake Tahoe all those years. As a matter of fact, I'm sitting in that view I just showed you. I've been looking at that view for 50 years.
That's amazing.
But Bert, do you remember my wife, Bobby?
Yeah, I met her when she was, when you guys were, you had her over there in Saudi. Yeah.
Right. Tremendous lady. So she was a TWA flight attendant. I'd come in off an 880 trip, and she hated the 880. Matter of fact, every flight attendant I've ever talked to hated the Convair 880 to work, but I love flying it. Mm-hmm. But in any event, so she came back off a 7-0 trip, and she was a senior to me. And we were living in Malibu, California at the time and just married. And she says, honey, you know, we want to have children, but I don't think Malibu, California is a good place to raise them. How about if we move to Lake Tahoe? I said, oh, honey, I love you. Ooh, wow. Yeah. I grabbed her, brought her up here. We bought the property in October of 69, built the house in 70. And been here ever since. Yeah. Raised five kids. The fifth kid was me, according to my wife.
I remember being over there, and you sent her and the kids up to somewhere in Europe, didn't you, for school?
Well, what I did was, one of the reasons we stayed there, we went over for 18 months like you, and then we stayed 7 years because I rented a house or a villa in a different European country each year. So the kids got out of school kind of early because they didn't believe in Easter. Then they went back to school in September. So they had a nice long summer vacation. So the first year we lived in Zandvoort, Holland, and then the next year down off the coast of Italy and eventually France and Spain and Germany and all over the place.
So would you commute from Jeddah up to those places?
Yes, I did. As a matter of fact, when we were living in Spain, I don't know whether you remember or not, but we had that 1 week trip to Madrid from Jeddah. And it was only one flight a week. Great. So I'd give a line check up to Madrid, get off the airplane, and Bobby and the kids would be at the villa and whatnot, spend a week up there. Then the next flight down, then I'd give a check ride back to Jeddah.
Oh, what a deal. What a deal.
Yeah. Oh, God, it was really great. Yeah.
That reminds me of that one flight that we flew into, was it Dar es Salaam or somewhere in Africa, and we'd go, there was one flight a week there also, then we'd go land one day, go on safari, play, and then come back a week later and resume the flight, as I remember. I think that was in somewhere in Africa.
Yeah, that was
Nairobi.
I think it was Nairobi.
Yeah. No wonder the airlines went broke, Will, you know?
Yeah, that was one flight a week. I mean, we can figure that one out.
Yeah. Remember, we'd go and hit the ground, we'd party like crazy, and then we'd sober up, and then we'd go on safari, and then come back and get straight and go fly again.
Exactly. I mean, and then collect a big paycheck at the end of the month. Say, whoa, this is...
It's a hell of a deal. Yeah, for sure.
Oh, yeah. And like you said, that was really the queen of the skies days that we were involved with that airline.
Never again. I mean, you can't even describe something like that to the millennial pilots.
No, you know, when I talk to people about that, especially the new guys and whatnot, they think I'm lying.
Yeah, exactly. Well, they don't want to admit that that could have ever happened, for if they allowed themselves to even think about it, it would drive them crazy.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
And then 1991, TWA had a contract with, here's another license to steal, with Nippon Cargo. So I went over there, checked out on their 747-200 freighters, and I was with them for 5 years. Boy, that was really great. I was also a check captain with the Japanese ANA, Nippon Cargo, as it were. You know. So,
yeah, I remember Tom Rosen was over there with you, wasn't he?
That's right. Yeah. Matter of fact, Tom and I stay in contact. Matter of fact, I just got a really nice email from him.
It's here that Bill describes a flight they were flying for Nippon Cargo, where a friend of ours, Tom Rosen, and he were shooting the approach to San Francisco and landing on runway 1 right. It was very seldom used for landings, and this particular time it was because the winds were coming out of the northeast, and the hills rise up to the south when you're making the approach to 1 way run right to land. and it makes it very tricky. You've got to have the aircraft in the proper landing configuration as you come in over those hills. And then there was, at the time, a group of very tall eucalyptus trees. So Bill describes that situation here. There was also a Japanese captain in the jump seat riding on this particular flight, so that's when he mentions Captain Yoshida.
We had Captain Yoshida in the jump seat and going L.A. back to San Francisco. Well, it was one of those rare days where the wind was right down runway one, so they landed on one right. And I had been in there on the 707 landing on one right, so I knew just exactly where you had to make the turn. What I was doing was making it a DME radius approach because, yeah, you know, you come in low over that hill and you had to be right on it, because if you weren't, you'd break out, you'd be high fast, and there's just no way. Go around time, you know, something like that. And you couldn't be too low and slow.
Yeah, because so you're cleaning the eucalyptus leaves out of your landing gear.
Exactly. And Tom was flying. I gave him the leg and I said, Captain Yoshida, if you don't mind, I'm going to let Tom make the approach and the landing because I know how to get the airplane in there. And Tom, I'll give you all the information that you need. He's a really good pilot too, like you. Mm-hmm. And so what I was doing, I was watching the DME off the end of runway one right and whatnot. I said, okay, slow down, airspeed's fine. Be able to get the flaps and the gear out and that kind of stuff, and made the turn to final and rolled right out on the VASI lights. And mm-hmm. Captain Yoshida says, so, yeah, and Tom went in, made a hell of a nice landing and all that kind of stuff. But then Yoshida called me in the office and he says, Captain, you think that was smart since you have experience? And I thought it was safer since I knew what to do, when to do it. And Tom's a good pilot, and let him do it, because not only that, he can see the runway from his side of the airplane.
Sure.
Yeah, we're coming in on a high right base, you know?
Yeah.
Right. So Tom said, Bill, I'd never forget that. And thank you for your trust in me and my flying capability. And that was like about 2 weeks ago.
Wow, that's beautiful. It's here where we're winding up the interview with Bill, but I asked him if he wanted to finish up with anything in particular, and he started to talk about his true heroics. He goes from an everyday hero to a real hero.
Other than through this wonderful life of mine, I have saved 5 lives. I've always been a strong swimmer, and all of them had to do with picking people out of rivers and that kind of stuff. And I've been through EMT training. And
I had no idea. You're definitely more than just an everyday hero. You're a real hero.
Let's see. Was that the last one or one before last? My family and I, we were camping out down in Yosemite. It was April, and the McCollum River was running high and all that kind of stuff, you know. And I had just finished making camp, and I walked over to the river and looked down and said, wow, there's a hairbrush floating downstream. Well, what it was a blonde kid with a crew cut. That was what the brush, there was a body under that thing.
And God.
Yeah, I dove in, got him, he was 12 years old. Yeah, I got him and he's coughing and spitting. Yeah, I pumped the water out of him and picked him up and brought him back to he was the son of some people camping up the stream a little ways from where we were. And I brought him back. Is does this belong to you? And Mom was, oh God, she hugged me. And yeah, really, it was just one of those fate and destiny things, Bert. I mean, 2 seconds sooner or 2 seconds later, I'd have never seen him.
It's here that Bill describes his own miracle on the Hudson up in Newburgh, New York, on the Hudson River.
Before I went out to L.A. to get my licenses and whatnot, I was an operating engineer at the Central Hudson Gas and Electric. Here again, it was April. A buddy of mine and I went up to the top of the steam station.
Where was this, Will?
This was in Newburgh, New York.
And, oh, okay.
And so we're saying, I call what we were burning when I smoked at the time. And I looked out on the Hudson River, and it was full of ice that was breaking up. And I said to my buddy, I said, oh, Christ, hey, there's a boat out there upside down. So, hey, God, there's 4 guys hanging on to it. Excuse me, 3 guys. So we went down and we had these little rowboats, you know, little aluminum skiffs to take care of the intakes of the power plant and all that kind of stuff. So I told the shift operator, I said, hey, there's 3 guys out there in the river in a capsized boat. we need to go get them. He said, yeah, go get them. So we did, rode out. I said to the guys, I said, okay, now, please don't try to get into our boat. Just hang on, right, and we'll tow you to shore, which we did. And lo and behold, it was a grandfather, a son, and a grandson. And we hauled them out of the water. And by that time, the meds had gotten there, you know, because the hypothermia was starting to set in and all that kind of stuff. They were floating around with ice all over the water.
Oh, wow.
So, yeah. Yeah, so we got all written up in the paper and blah, blah, and all that kind of stuff. I still have the articles. And so just, wow. Yeah, right place at the right time.
Yeah, that's beautiful.
And being able to do the right thing, because, like I said, I was a really strong swimmer still to this day.
Well, listen, Will, I'm going to end it on that because I love the way it wrapped up with that story. Because
oh, well, thank you.
It's perfect.